So in our last episode, we had Steve Magnus, the mental performance coach and the author of the best-selling book, Do Hard Things. And we really focused in on leading with fear, how leading with fear is unhealthy. Now, but today we're actually going to be talking about, you know, building mental toughness and confidence within athletes. And this is an area where I think coaches actually lead out of fear. We lead out of fear. What do I mean by that? Well, we're afraid to make decisions, decisions as a coach, or to hold players accountable for behaviors or their performance because we are afraid of how the athlete or athletes will respond. An example of this is when you have, let's say, a player that's really high up in your lineup, let's say even just a starter, and they have a string of bad games. A player behind them in the lineup now is probably playing better than them consistently, but we're afraid to move the player down the lineup out of fear their confidence will be forever shattered and we'll lose them. This is coaching out of fear. And the solution isn't just go, hey, go and make the hard decision and hope, you know, for the best. Like, we need to be intentional in our coaching. First, we need to have empathy. We need to encourage and affirm the individual that we believe in them. We believed in them and still believe in them. But at the same time, we got to go and make that hard decision, right? To make that decision about what's best for the team. But also, if we really want to be our best as a coach, we're not just going to encourage and affirm. We will work to help equip them with tools to overcome this setback, this challenge. And that's what Steve Magnus is so darn good at. He's one of the best in the world at it, and it's what he's going to be talking about in today's episode. Welcome to the Coaching Culture Podcast. If you're a new listener, welcome. My name is JP Nurbin. I'm the founder of this podcast, the author of the book, The Culture System, a proven process for creating an extraordinary team culture. And I'm the founder of TOC, which provides online courses and one-on-one coaching for coaches. I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Nate Sanderson. The mission of this podcast is to help leaders grow and build better team cultures. Don't forget, you do not need to take notes. Just subscribe to our weekly newsletter to get the notes to this and every episode of the podcast. You can do that at tocculture.com. With that, you'll also get a free chapter of my book, The Culture System. Now, let's get into the second half of our conversation with Steve Magnus. I think, too, one of the things I really resonated here in your book with was your constant coming back to military and what the military does that's so effective when it comes to training mental toughness and mental resiliency. And, you know, one of those is giving them the tools to then be able to manage the stressful situation. Because a lot of coaches will say to me, like, well, JP, I get this, but, like, you know, my job is to put them through in a really stressful environment so, like, you know, that they can, like, get through stress in a game. I'm like, yeah, but, like, that doesn't need to be you yelling and screaming at them. One of the things that you talk about is, like, that old school, like, the hell week where, like, we're going to wean out them all the weaklings here. You know, who wants to commit? You talk a lot about that in the book as just not being beneficial. And my question for you is, and I want you, if I'm wrong on this, I want you to tell me I'm wrong. I'm definitely not in favor of the old school hell week where the coaches are just ripping into guys and telling them, you know, how, you know, or girls, and just how sorry they are, how weak they are. But I love the idea of getting a team together. For me, as a basketball team, we'd go to the beach, we'd have a tournament at the beach, and we would do some workouts together, positive encouragement with some ridiculous goals. And I always felt that that connected us. My experience taught me that we could connect by doing some hard things together. Was I wrong in that, or is it how it's being coached or delivered?
It's how it is. It's how it's being coached. So you're absolutely right in the sense that doing hard things together creates bonding. And the reason for that is pretty simple, is because when we do a hard workout or we do something difficult together that is challenging and there's a shared goal, is you can't fake it. You have to be yourself, right? The difficult thing breaks it down. This is why if you've played sports, like, you probably have really good relationships that last with your high school or your college teammates, because you went through the highs and lows together, right? You got to see people struggle and fail or even cry after games, which we never show in the real world. So often those difficult, you know, workouts or preseason, whatever have you, can function to, you know, create those bonds. But it's, as you said, they have to be in an environment that allows us to kind of take risks, fail, like struggle if we have to get people through, but ultimately build us up. And where people get it wrong is they just see the hard thing and they don't see the like support, bonding, the environment that promotes growth that is around the descriptor that you called it. You know, in track, I would call it, every once in a while we would do a workout where we called it a see God workout, which meant like we were going to go so hard that like you might be on the track like and think you're about to die and go see God. And kids, you know, if, you know, athletes would be like, okay, like this is gonna kind of suck, but let's go for it. Let's see what's there. And you wouldn't do this all the time, right? But you would do it every once in a while where you're like, okay, let's see what's at the bottom of the well in a positive environment. And wherever kids found that bottom of the well, I wasn't going to be like, oh, you got one more rep. I was going to be like, hey, if this is, you're telling me this is the bottom, then great job, man. Like you went to the well, good stuff. And it really is that environment that that allows us to get those positive benefits out of it.
Yeah, I appreciate that because I know my own individual personal experience in the last year running ultras, like it changes you doing something hard. But there was also this unique experience where I kind of initially was kind of running the ultras and I was like, I'm going to be like in my own world. I don't want to connect. I don't want to talk to anybody. But I found when I actually connected with the other runners on the trails, it was a really, it was motivating. I felt surges of adrenaline as when I would try to help another runner, they might help me. And I started to, I know it's, you know, it's 200 people over the span of like, you know, 60 miles, but you're still like that sense of community was often very inspiring for me.
Yeah, it is. And that's why I love, you know, running is often seen as an individual sport, but there's a mutual respect because like you're going through this crazy difficult thing. And I think we can have that in any sport. And that's where I think the value of sport is if we create that environment where it's like, yeah, we're going to take on challenges. We're going to take, you know, push ourselves to sometimes the extremes of what we're capable of, but do it in a way that allows us to grow and develop instead of a way that, hey, the only reason I'm pushing to this point is because I don't want to get in trouble or because my coach is going to yell and scream at me. Then like, that can be a very good thing. So like, how do we create that environment is really important.
Well, let's push on that a little bit, because I think, you know, in my experiences as well, that when we've, I'll just give you another example, known that we're going into a game where there's going to be bad officiating, and not to throw the officials under the bus right away, but when kids just go in and know, look, they're not going to bail you out. There's going to be some calls that nobody in this understands. The crowd's going to be going berserk and we just have to play through it. I've seen other teams be way more affected by something like that than ours when we've done some front loading, you know, to sort of prepare them for that. And I don't know if you could explain a little bit of the psychology, because you talk in the book about framing things as challenges is kind of a key to unlocking, you know, a better approach, obviously, than just reacting to whatever they experience in the moment.
Yeah, absolutely. So what happens is when we face some sort of, you know, stressful situation or something that pushes the bounds of what we're capable of, we can either see it as a challenge or a threat. And depending on what way we frame it, we'll actually shift our biology a little bit. So if we see things as a threat, we're more likely to go into like protect and defend mode. We're more likely to have a higher level of stress hormones like cortisol. If we see things as a challenge, we're more likely to go into mode where instead of protecting and defending, we approach the challenge and we have higher levels or more adrenaline and less cortisol. So we're ready, prepared to take on and take action. And a lot of it really comes down to the framing, which is, you know, is this something that I can handle? And is this something that I'm prepared for and know kind of, you know, what to face? Because the other part of it is we're more likely to see things as a threat if they come in incredibly unexpected and like, you know, you think you're the official is going to be pretty good, but all of a sudden you get all these horrible calls. Well, you're more likely to spiral out of control there. If you know on the front hand and are prepared, this is going to be part of it. Like, we might not get some good calls. We might have some things go the wrong way. Then like that, that frames it where you're more likely to go down that biological challenge state, which, you know, allows us to perform better.
Well, I want to ask you a few questions here that are a little bit of potpourri. So I'm going to give you just a few kind of things that coaches sometimes struggle with that, you know, I connected with in different ways as I've just been learning some of your stuff here. And you know, one of the things that you spent some time on is just raising confidence. And I love this phrase that you use, that confidence requires evidence, you know, and as I look at the growth of teams, I'll just give you an example. I took over a program last year, 1-20 the year before. We made it to 500 last year. This year we're ranked, like, we've been growing, you know, progressively over the last year and a half. And to start this season, in the first half of the year, we were 7-4. We had 4 losses to top 10 teams. We led in the second half of all 4 of those games and couldn't close any of them. And so it feels like we're like grasping at jello, where just the confidence down the stretch, until we do it, I don't know how to necessarily to create it, right? Until the evidence is there, then it's easy. Then you're making a case, right? You're showing them the film. You're talking about the success we've had. We know we can do this. So when coaches are in that building stage with an athlete or with a team and the evidence isn't there yet, what are the steps to trying to start to build that confidence?
Yeah. So a couple of things that are really important is, first, lower the bar. So if you're still losing a lot and you're not in that space, then what you need to do is, in practice, create things where people can grow off of. So that whether that's drills or certain, you know, challenges that you give them, create space where they can succeed at something and then see that they are literally getting better. So sometimes this is why I love, you know, film is, you know, occasionally you will use a jump shot. You film a jump shot and at, you know, practice number 1, it looked like A. Practice number 25, it looks like, you know, B, and B is much better. Well, you show them that. You show them how they've progressed, because often as athletes, even in practice and even on the skills that we do all the time, we kind of default towards the negative and we don't see the progress that we've made. So give them places for progress and then show them those results. And then the other part of it is, again, we talked about challenge versus skill, is framing it correctly. So if you're in that kind of struggle, we're going to lose a lot, what you have to do is give them some avenues where they see, okay, we're going to lose. The outcome might not be here, but here, what are the processes that we need to do to get better over the long haul? So zoom them way out, right? Instead of from game to game or day to day, say like, hey, this might be a little bit of a rebuild, but, you know, we're going to get better at this. And you guys, here are the steps to do so, and give them that clarity on role, on their kind of role in progress. That goes a long way for developing confidence as well.
Yeah, I like that, because I think, you know, that comes back to this internal drive of mastery, which I think sometimes we hear that word and we think becoming the master of. And they think, oh boy, I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to attain that. But really, it's the evidence of competency, not only for self, but for the process, right? So as we're getting closer to being able to close a game in the final minutes, you know, maybe growth for us would be, we don't turn it over, we just miss the shots that we create. Then the next step is, you know, we've created these great opportunities, now can we take advantage of them, whatever that might be. But I think you're right on, where the evidence doesn't necessarily have to be mastery in that sense of we only winning and losing, but we're proving in a sense the process along the way is benefiting us, which hopefully drives more buy-in and effort as we go along.
It absolutely. And you know, I'm going to go off of a sport for a minute to drive this home, but the wonderful Stanford neurobiologist Robert Sapolsky did some research, and then in one of his books outlined this, where he said we all need to feel like we are making progress and feeling significant. And we often think about that in terms of like the results, but that significance and mastery can come from even small things. So the example he used is, if you're, you know, low on the totem pole in the workplace, often you feel kind of apathetic and your motivation drops because maybe you're at the bottom rung and you're not making progress. But research shows if you look at, you know, health, happiness, performance, if that person, and this is the example Sapolsky used, if that person got his competency in that moment from being the star on the company softball team, that is enough. That will stoke their intrinsic motivation. So in the sport world, what I look for is, okay, if we're not at the point where we're winning yet, go down a level, go down a level. Where can I find that competency, that mastery, whatever you want to call it, that progress? Where can I find that at a smaller level to kind of build them up and then work towards that overarching goal?
No, that's great. Now, I want to ask you your response to this. So sometimes in the NCAA tournament, you know, the shoe companies, they make their shirts and all the teams wear them on the sideline. And one of the popular phrases that I've seen here in the last year says, do it anyway. And I think in some ways this echoes a bit of the conversation that we've already had, but I want to steer this a little bit more toward kind of an emotional intelligence slash awareness, you know, lens here, that I think inherent in that phrase is you may not feel like it, or you might feel run down, or you might feel discouraged today, but do it anyway. You know, you grab your bootstraps and you just do it. And I think your approach is a little bit different than just push it to the side and find a way, right? So what's your response when you're watching the game and you see everybody has a shirt on that says, do it anyway?
So here, I love the example of climbers. So those who are trying to climb Mount Everest or some sort of big mountain, right? These guys are tough. They're climbing, they're going through crazy conditions, right? Everything's kind of frozen. They've spent months and years like training for this one thing. Well, if you talk to climbers, they'll tell you like the most difficult moment is often when you're getting closer to the peak, right? You can see it. Maybe it's a couple hundred meters away. It's a couple hours. You're almost there. You know you can make it to the top. But the question isn't making it to the top. Is it, can I make it to the top and then come all the way back down the mountain safe? Because the important part is, yeah, I got this goal, which is pulling me, make it to the top of the mountain, but I got to get home for my wife, my kids, my family, my parents, whatever have you. And the easy decision often in that moment is just forget it. Make it to the top. Like that's the goal that is. Do it anyway. Forget everything else. But if you do it anyway and you didn't take the moment to say, hey, do I have the energy, the resources to make it all the way down? You're risking your life and you potentially die. So sport isn't life or death. But to me, like that analogy tells us that the tough moment isn't to do it anyway. It's to have the self-awareness to say, what is the right decision, given my goals, my values, you know, my ethics in this moment? Is it to do it anyway? Sometimes it is, but sometimes it's not. It's to choose to go down the mountain. And I think that nuanced approach to kind of toughness is really what it's all about.
I think that's a really great reminder, not just for the athlete, but for the coaches, because so often coaches are willing to sacrifice so much to get to the top, you know, and then only to get there to realize and then realize that they, you know, left a lot of bodies in their wake, you know, honestly, you know, just a lot of broken relationships and to their own mental health. So I think that's really, really a great reminder. Something I wanted to kind of explore with you too, that I read in the book that a little bit ties back to what we were talking about earlier, is just this idea around inherent laziness, and that you kind of say, have an argument against that. You talk about an example. I think it was the Secretary of the Treasury during like COVID was saying, well, if we continue to give out unemployment payments, then, you know, people will continue to not work. But you really believe that people have a desire to work and to get after it. There isn't this inherent laziness that so often we assume in our athletes or we assume in human beings. I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite topics because it's so ingrained in our society that if left to our own devices, we'll just be lazy. But if that was the case, like we as people, as humans, wouldn't be where we're at right now. Because like we've innovated, we've discovered, we've challenged, we've, you know, explored, and we are the descendants of those explorers that like made their way to America and across and all that stuff. So it is in our nature to, you know, challenge, to explore, to do hard work. But I think what we miss is that the modern environment often sets us up to feel kind of unimportant, you know, unmotivated, all that good stuff. And then we blame it on the individual. And it's just not the case. And it's not just like, hey, this is, you know, theory here. There's decades of research that shows that essentially, you know, for the vast majority of people, if you make them feel, you know, secure, if you give them a path to progress, if you make them feel like they belong and are connected, then their motivation will go up and they'll be motivated. And we know this in the workplace too, is that we often look at like the dangling extrinsic carrots like money and we think, oh, this is the motivator. But there was, I don't remember the exact figures on the research, but there was a large study that looked at, you know, the amount of salary and the job satisfaction and motivation. And salary explained something like, I don't know, 3% of like the impact of like job satisfaction and motivation. So it's like, yeah, it works a little bit, but it's like so minimal, especially if your basic, you know, needs are taken care of.
I want to ask you about another one here. All right. There's another term that spoke to my heart as a parent and as a coach. And that is you've got a section in the book about spiraling. And as the father of a 5-year-old and an 8-year-old at home, I see this happen in our household all the time when there's only one toy to be shared or there's only one cookie left in the cookie jar. You know, there's a constant. I mean, you can see it coming, right? You've got kids and you know, oh, here's the tone of voice. And now here's the tantrum. And now here we go. But we see this in our, you know, in players as well, that there are times where something doesn't go right and then they get scored on at the other end. And then all of a sudden their countenance and their body language, you can just see the whole thing starting to spiral. So I don't know if you could just talk us through a little bit as coaches, when you start to see this process happening, how we can best be able to support our athletes, both in the moment, but also preparing them for the moment when we know this is inevitable, right? This is part of the human experience. How do we approach this?
Yeah, this is the name of the game in sport. I was actually talking to a basketball player yesterday who was like, you know, I just missed the shot. And then I felt like, you know, I spiraled, my confidence left. I didn't feel, you know, I was just losing it. And that's kind of human nature. That's how we kind of deal with things. So as a coach, what you want to look for, or as a parent, like you look for, you know, what are those signs when you start to see someone spiral? And then how do you dislodge and change their perspective? Because spiraling is often narrowing. So when we miss that shot, we spiral because our brain gets locked on, I miss that shot. All you think about, you ruminate on, I miss that shot, right? And you can't see anything else. So as a coach, it's how do I zoom someone out? How do I dislodge that pattern of spiraling and get them out of that? And there's a number of different ways, right? One is just changing their focus, right? Their focus is on that shot. How do you zoom it out and shift their focus to something else like that they might be doing well? Hey, I want you to focus on defense for the next play or whatever have you, right? You're changing it. Another, you know, outside of sport, perspective changing. So if I'm public speaking and I'm really nervous or struggling, I wear glasses for the listeners who obviously can't see. But research shows that if I take off my glasses, because it changes how I see the world, that anxiety will go down and my focus will shift. Now, if you don't have glasses, guess what? You can do the same thing by changing your vision from focusing maybe like narrowly on what you're doing, maybe the basketball or what have you, to just zooming out, like adopting a soft gaze and just like looking at the periphery. That will get you out of that spiral as well. And then other things, you can change how you're talking, you know, your self-talk from first person to third person. Actually, there's some great research behind that that shows that that kind of dislodges you. And you can change, you know, your kind of perspective on, you know, one of the things that I like to do as a runner, and JP might, you know, resonate with this is when you're in a really long race, what happens is you get locked on, this sucks, I still have a really long way to go. So you can start changing what you're thinking about, right? You can think about your, you know, your supporters, what your family thinks, what they would say in this moment. Or one of my favorite, how will I look back on this moment when I'm done with this race? Because at some point I'm going to be done. And changing that perspective of like, oh yeah, I'll look back at this and think, hey, you were complaining at mile, you know, 10 of 26, like in the grand scheme of things, this was a very brief moment and you'll get through it. So anything that can zoom us out and change that perspective will really help with that spiraling out of control.
Well, I'm glad you said that. That affirms me as a coach, because last night we were struggling and got behind and we were down 25 or 27 going into the fourth quarter, whatever it was. And as a team collectively, you know, we could just see our effort kind of dwindling, what have you. And so my speech or my timeout between the third and fourth quarter was, listen, you know, what's on the scoreboard doesn't have to affect who we are. And we talk about, you know, wanting to be here to enjoy playing together. It's nothing they can take away from us. It's nothing the scoreboard can take away from us. Let's go out the last 8 minutes and just, we only have so many games left this year. Make sure that we enjoy playing together, having, you know, having each other's back, celebrating each other, that sort of thing. And we were fine in the fourth quarter. There's no Hollywood story. We came back and won or anything like that. But it was a way to ground us in something that was, you know, zooming out, right? Totally different from the mindset that was, you know, clearly inhibiting us prior to that.
Yeah, you shift the perspective, you shift the attention, and you shift the goal, right? The running example is, if I'm trying to break 3 hours in marathon and it's a hot day and it doesn't look like it, I don't say, oh, okay, this is horrible. Well, that might be what I do if I spiral. I shift that goal. Well, I'm going to maybe try to break 3:15 or focus on, it's a tough day. I'm going to try and be the toughest I can out here and forget about the outcome, right? It just shifts things and allows you and frees you up from that spiral of negativity.
You also talk about there are times where it can be more beneficial to zoom in. Do you want to give us the contrasting perception of that?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's some wonderful research that they've looked at clutch performances. So when people come through the clutch, and what happens is they're able to hold that kind of like negativity or whatever out to the side and zoom in on exactly what they're doing in the moment. So to contrast it, we've all experienced flow. Flow generally occurs when we kind of zoom out and are in the zone and just letting our body do its thing. Clutch is very different in the sense that it's like effortful and like you're like focused and having to struggle, but you're doing the thing. And research shows that when we like zoom in on the task, then that allows us to kind of get in that clutch state. So the example, again, sorry, more running examples, but instead of thinking about the crowd or my family or what have you, I might zoom all the way in and be like, hey, I need to, you know, push off the ground more or lengthen my stride in this moment and just focus on exactly what needs to be done in that moment. Now, the thing is, this is those clutch moments, like they're kind of fleeting. So it's like you do it for when it works and then you got to get back out, because if you stay in there too long, too zoomed in, what happens is the running example, like I'm thinking about my stride. Well, that allows the opportunity for me to think about, well, my legs don't feel that good right now. They're really heavy or tired or fatigued. And that can overwhelm and take over your kind of mental standpoint. So you really got to like zoom in, think about what you need to do, and then get out.
And I've seen examples. I remember watching a video of Jimmy Connors back in the day, you know, after a mistake. And if you'd watch him in his matches, he would pull his racket up to his face and start picking the lint from the tennis ball off of the string of his racket, you know, as a way to zoom out or zoom in and crowd out, you know, all of these other things that were going on in between points. But obviously he doesn't stay there, right? He's got 12 seconds between serves or whatever it was to get in and get out and recenter and then play. Well, I want to ask you about one more thing, and then JP's got a couple to get you out the door here. All right. I really appreciated in the book kind of the language that you use to describe the awareness of our emotion, particularly as it relates to our limbic system and some of the threat responses and we could probably do a whole podcast on that, and maybe we'll bring you back and do that sometime. But JP and I have done a couple of coaching retreats over the years and spent a lot of time sort of unpacking how the brain works. And one of the analogies that I've used in that teaching is, if we see the limbic system as, or that anxiety or the heart rate and the sweaty palms and all those things that happen when we start to perceive a threat, as an alarm, rather than, you know, as just a call to battle, that it starts to create a little bit of space, right, for being aware and asking questions and almost being curious to better understand it, rather than just let it take hold of us, you know, and move us to a state where we kind of do lose control. So I don't know if you could briefly, you know, kind of explain that framework. And obviously there's a lot we could do here, but just the importance of being able to perceive those particular threat emotions.
Yeah. So I love that analogy you use, because it's very similar to what I use, in the sense that we need to see our internal signals, our emotions, our feelings as like messengers. Like they are the way that our brain figures, you know, what's going on in our body. Like our brain is locked in our head. It's stuck there. The only way it can understand the outside world is through our sensory system. And yeah, we all know that through vision, but we have these other sensory systems like feelings and emotions that act as the kind of messengers. So instead of seeing them as like dictators, where it's like, oh, I'm feeling anxious, that must mean I'm about to, you know, choke or not perform well or what have you, but just a communication device, right? It's, oh, I'm feeling a little bit of, you know, sweaty palms or a little jittery or what have you. It's like, well, I could interpret that and say, I feel anxiety and I'm about to not perform well. Or I could interpret it and say, you know what? My body and brain know that I'm about to like go into action and I need some adrenaline, and it's getting my muscles prepared to move because it knows I'm about to do a lot of movements, and it's getting my heart rate up because it knows it has to deliver oxygen to everything in my body. And that interpretation will shift, you know, not only some hormones, but it'll shift kind of like our performance state. And I think that goes a long way and is really impactful to performance. So what I tell people, similar to what you did, is like, make friends with your emotions. Like, decide which ones you want to listen to in terms of if that message is a good one to listen to and how you're going to interpret it, or decide that sometimes you're going to see it, I don't know, like your crazy aunt or uncle ranting on Facebook, and you're just going to be like, yeah, I'm just going to scroll on by this one. Like this message isn't one I should read.
Well, and I think the key word there is you're creating space for a decision, right? Rather than just a reaction. And, you know, one of the analogies I use, we've got two dogs here in the house, and it's a miracle that they haven't been barking while we've been in this interview. But yesterday the Amazon truck came in and, you know, drops a box off, and usually I'm not home working at school, but I'm home yesterday. And so my retriever, you know, goes up to the window and bark, 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 you know, sounding the alarm that somebody is here. And that's the job, right, of the watchdog, but is also trained well enough that after I've heard a few barks and I look out the window, I can tell Sheffield, okay, that's enough. In other words, I'm acknowledging, dog, you did your job and you're doing your work here. I've decided that the Amazon guy isn't a threat, and I'm going to move on here. But the dog then is like, okay, I was heard. Now I can go back and take my nap. And in a lot of ways, that's kind of what we're trying to get to with an awareness of our threat response.
Bingo. Man, you nailed it there. I'm going to borrow your analogy, because my dog does the same thing, responds in the same way. But that's what we're trying to do, right? Is we can react and go nuts on the Amazon, or we could have that space where we start to go that way. Maybe we bark some, but then you get that acknowledgement, that space that says, okay, it's all good. Like the Amazon guy isn't breaking down the door. We're okay. Like, turn the alarm off.
Well, I tell my dog to shut up and he doesn't get quiet, so I don't know what I'm doing wrong. Feels like I think that's more like my limbic system. I think it takes on my personality. But Steve, this has been an amazing conversation. Your book has, when I read it, has moved to the very top for books to recommend to coaches on mental toughness and just, you know, if you got players that struggle with confidence. And I felt so good the other day. Someone sent me a photo of, you know, on Amazon, it says frequently bought together. They had Do Hard Things, my book, I think Doug Lamov's, and maybe it was Cody Royal's Tough Stuff. It was like, oh man, I felt like it was really cool just to see my book next to yours. So I highly recommend that one for all the listeners, but I love to ask, I love book recommendations. I love reading. I know you do too. Give us a book recommendation and also someone, obviously you're an amazing follow on Twitter. First off, you actually have great stuff. I follow you and enjoy your stuff, but someone maybe that we should, not just a book recommendation, but maybe someone that we should follow on social or even potentially have on this podcast as a guest.
Oh man, those are good questions and tough ones off the top of my head, because that makes me think. Book recommendations. I loved actually a coaching book recently by Rob Gray, How We Learn to Move. It was just a different look at coaching that I think was wonderful. So Rob Gray's How We Learn to Move. Another one that I really liked recently that goes along this theme of toughness is Quit by Annie Duke, who looks at kind of the benefits of quitting. And then on social, oh man, I follow a lot of good people who are interesting. Who would I give? You know, I'll tell you, my co-author on a couple of different books, I got to tell you, Brad Stolberg is a great follow. There's a researcher named Ethan Molnick who gives some great work. It's not in coaching, but it's in kind of like business and education that is some wonderful work. And then in the sports science world, Dr. Cian Allen does a great job of breaking down the latest in kind of coaching and sports science on Twitter. And I love following her for that.
Yeah, I appreciate those, because like you said, like we don't need to even pick up every book, you know, though coaches do need to pick up your book because it's really, really that good. But I appreciate those recommendations for sure. It's been a great, great conversation. Thanks for all you're doing and coaching, you know, getting a very important message out there and being able to bring a research-based approach to it. Like, I think that's just absolutely critical.
Well, thanks so much, guys. I really enjoyed this conversation and the work that you guys are doing. So keep it up.
Okay, huge thanks to Steve Magnus. Obviously, I loved his book. What a great conversation. Honestly, it was just incredible. This is the type of episode you just share with a lot of other coaches, because you know this stuff is absolute gold, right? So grateful to have this conversation with such a brilliant coach. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast if you don't already. And dang it, if you haven't subscribed to our newsletter at tocculture.com, you are missing out on the podcast notes as well as some weekly messages around culture. So check it out.